everyone. Yesterday we had a day of sunshine. My goodness, it was wonderful.
And we're paying for it today with cold.
Yeah, but no ice raining.
That is true. Still ice left on the driveway, but no new ice. And that's
right.
You know, that's an Iowa winter. We haven't had a lot of real Iowa winters in recent years, so we can't complain.
No, true.
Too much.
No, but I'm going to complain anyway.
Well, our book today is set a long way from Iowa.
Oh, yes, it is.
Why don't you introduce our guest, Mom?
Our guest today is John Thorndike. And John grew up in New England and graduated from Harvard, took an MA from Columbia, and then lit out for Latin America. He spent 2 years in the Peace Corps in El Salvador and 2 with his wife and child on a backcountry farm in Chile. Eventually, he settled with his son in Athens, Ohio. Now, he has written several books and 2 memoirs, and this book is, the name of it is 100 Fires in Cuba, and it's a very interesting book. So, I'd like to introduce you to John Thorndike.
Welcome to Writer's Voices, John.
Very happy to join you today.
Okay, 100 Fires in Cuba. What drew you, now this is a book that is set around the Cuban Revolution, it's a novel, but it features a real historical person. What drew you to this subject?
I was always drawn to Cuba. I remember being in the, in the 60s when some of my friends went down and worked in the Vincent Amos Brigades. Those were groups of people who went down there and cut sugar cane to help Cuba out. All of Cuba was cutting sugar cane, including Fidel Castro, who took one afternoon a week out to cut cane. It's a brutal job. And I just was interested in Cuba. And then on the other angle, and this is an historical novel, so you have all kinds of things that are absolutely historically correct, and then you have the novel part of it. And the novel part was that I was working on a book about my mother, or about a character inspired by my mother. It wasn't working out very well. And then one day I read that this famous to some, Cuban revolutionary, Camilo Cienfuegos, that is Cien Fuegos, that's 100 Fires in Spanish, that's the title of the book, that he had come to New York in the 50s and was working at the Waldorf Astoria as a line cook. And it just suddenly occurred to me that the character in my book that I had paired up with my mother, and it wasn't working out well, this guy would be much better. And suddenly, I had Camilo Cienfuegos in my novel.
So the woman is patterned after your mother, then?
Yes, to some degree. I mean, she is in the book. She's younger than she was when I was born, before she met my father, had all her history. I kind of wanted to get... My mother died when I was only 30. She was 57. And I hope to give her a chance at another life. That's what I was doing.
Wow. So how do you think, so the character in the book is named Claire. Did your mother actually live in New York during that time period?
To some degree, yes. Oh, she was in New York. It wasn't exactly at that time period.
Okay.
She was living in New York before I was born, starting in 1940, so it was some years earlier. And then actually remained in or around New York most of her life until she died in 1970.
And was she a photojournalist like Claire?
No, she wasn't. My mother was a doctor. She was an anesthesiologist.
Wow. So on the cover of 100 Fires in Cuba, there's a photograph. Is that the real Camilo Cienfuegos?
That is. And a very dashing guy. I went to the Miami Book Fair in December, and it was quite fascinating to find so many people who knew Camilo Cienfuegos. In the U.S., in Ohio, in Iowa, not so much. It's kind of rare. A few people know him. If you go to Cuba, Or you go to Miami. I mean, everyone knows this guy. In Cuba, he's as famous as Che Guevara and of equal stature. This is odd because we all know Che Guevara, right?
Right, right.
You go into the Plaza de la Revolución in Havana, and there are these two giant murals. And one of them is of Che Guevara with his beret. And the other one, facing the plaza in the same way, equal stature, that's Camilo Cienfuegos. And the reason, he was one of Fidel Castro's early comandantes, you know, one of his leaders up in the High Sierra. And one of the reasons that, or the reason we don't know him, is that he was there for the most of the first year of the revolution's success. He came in, he was head of the Cuban army. It could have been Che, but Fidel didn't want to make a foreigner head of the Cuban army. So Camilo was head of the Cuban army. And 10 months into that revolution success, he took off in a plane, an overland flight from the town of Camagüey, Cuba, up to Havana, just a little two-hour flight in a tiny two-engine Cessna. And that plane disappeared and was never found. And there we begin.
And are there, yeah, of course, in your novel, you have a story about what happened to that plane.
Yeah.
Are there rumors? Are there multiple theories? And how did you decide on which one to go with?
Yeah, endless theories and mainly two sides. Because if you go to Cuba and talk to people, Cubans are a little discreet about talking about some things, but everyone will tell you about Camilo, that his plane took off and a big storm came up and blew it out to sea, and he went down in the ocean and was never found. In Miami, the great majority of Cuban Americans, or as they usually call themselves, Cubans, they think that Fidel Castro had this guy killed because Camilo was too popular. He was not a socialist or a communist. The fact was, he was very loyal to Fidel. He was, as they say, a Fidelista. I've read everything I could read on it, and I don't have any proof. No one has any proof of what happened. I resolve it. He takes off in that plane, and after that, he's mine. After that, I don't have to follow all the things that he did. You know, when I'm writing the book, I mean, if you see him in the book and he goes off to England to buy some Hunter or Hawker jets, he did that in history. I mean, I thought, I don't change any history, but I add some to history. So after he disappears, I can add pretty much what I want or what he wants and what Claire wants.
Now, was there a real Claire in his life?
No, there wasn't. That is an invention of mine. There were quite a number of women. He was rather famous as a womanizer. Cuba loved him. He was funny. He was lighthearted. He was a man of the people. All the other leaders of that revolution, everyone who came over on that boat from Mexico to invade Cuba, those guys had all been to the university. Che, Raul, Fidel, Uber Matos, all those guys were university educated, and Camilo was not. His parents were tailors. He'd been through the eighth grade, but he was daring and funny and lively, and women liked him a lot.
You mentioned his parents were tailors. In the book, you describe them as anarchists, and they had moved to Cuba from somewhere else, Spain, maybe?
Northern Spain.
Northern Spain. Is that historically accurate?
Yes. All that kind of thing is accurate as I can make it. Oh, I never change things like that. Yeah.
Wow. So, John, tell us a little bit about your research process, how you actually go about finding these details, and also, whether you're writing, do you write something and you come to, I need to know what happened here, and then go look at research it, or have you done all the research and then you start writing and use what you have found in the writing?
It would be efficient if I did it that way, but my usual way is to write it and to get caught up in it and to plan things and start writing and then find that I have to go over it again and change things. But this is not a problem for me. That's the way I write. I rewrite endlessly. Basically, I had, as I said before, I'd been all interested in Cuba, and I interested in that revolution. I mean, it's the most romantic. Somebody would jump on me for that word, but it's a symbolic, fabulous little piece of history in which 82 men got on a boat in this little Mexican port town, that a boat that Fidel had bought, called the Grandma. He bought it from an American. The American had named it Grandma. And you can see that boat today. You go to the Museum of the Revolution, and out in back, under glass, you can see that boat. They don't want to let you on it, but you can go right up close and look at it. That's how famous it is. And so they come across 82 of them, and they land in a disastrous landing. And within days, the vast majority, perhaps 50 of those guys, have been killed. Some shot by Batista's troops, some surrendered and then executed. And about 15 of them made it up into the mountains. 15 people, 15 guys. And 2 years later, they take over the government of Cuba. It's quite a story. So I got all wrapped up in that, and that was the first time I heard about Camilo. He was the last one that got on the boat, and in my telling, this is a bit made up, but Raul was keeping track of the number, and Fidel said 80. You know, that's all. Raul said 80. That's it, Fidel. We can't take any more. And some other guy came up and said, let me on, my brother died at this invasion, this other invasion. And then Camilo steps up and he says, take me because I can shoot well. And Fidel says, yes, you are good. You're good with a gun. He's seen that in the training camps in Mexico. But there's no more room, I'm sorry. And Camilo says, and this is out of history, take me because I'm skinny and I'll fit. And that was just too much for Fidel. He took him. You know, that's how he got on board. So all those, you know, all that was just a delight to research and read all the different pieces I could read about it. And then when I'd settled on Camilo, I read a couple of books. There's almost nothing written about him. Carlos Franchi, who was the head of the radio station in the Sierra and later of the newspaper in Havana, he wrote a little book called Camilo Cienfuegos. I bought it for $100 on Amazon. It was the only one available in the world that I could find. And it's interesting, but there's so little. It's not like a biography you would write of any American hero. There's just not enough in it because not enough is known. And then later, when I went to Cuba in Havana in a little plaza which sells used books, I found this massive, turgid, usually boring book called Camilo Cienfuegos, El Señor de la Vanguardia, the man of the vanguard. He was always in the lead. You know, he always took the most dangerous position. And I read all that. It was mainly his speeches and where he went on this day and that day, and you know, about his character, very little. But
who had written that, and how did they have that information?
Yeah, that was written by a guy called William Galvez, who was part of the revolution and who devoted himself to all things Camilo. It's the kind of the official biography of Camilo.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is John Thorndike, author of 100 Fires in Cuba. So, Mom, do you remember this time period? Do you remember, like, what was going on in the U.S. when this was happening?
Well, actually, I had a classmate who was married to a doctor who had come from Cuba, and he had to take classes in, they didn't accept that he was a, you know, doctor. They had to take classes here again. So that's how she met him. She was in nursing school and he was in, you know,
medical school.
But yeah. So she, you know, she told me something about something, mentioned, you know, Batista and everything, and how glad he was that he had gotten out of Cuba. And my question is, were there a lot of people in Batista's army and so forth that were glad for this revolution, that gladly joined the revolution, or how did that happen?
That happened, and but those who were actually in Batista's army, one, they were under some danger of being punished by Fidel Castro and his brother, and of the common populace, Batista was not well liked. I mean, his National Guard had been raping and pillaging and stealing, and it was a nightmare. And so that is how 15 guys were able to, you know, everybody would join up with them because they were so fed up with Batista. Then when they took over everything, the original reaction was just wildly in favor. I mean, I've seen actual films of the day that Fidel came into Havana. And the Pueblo is just ecstatic. And, that, you know, over the years, that has ameliorated. That has turned a little bit. But at the time, they were so glad. The general population was vastly glad. Some of the very wealthy and some of the people, particularly in Batista's army, not so happy about it.
Well, in the book, when they... took over a lot of, it said that a lot of the wealthy people were trying to get out of Havana. They were trying to get out of Cuba.
Yes.
Did that happen?
And that did start right away, many of the wealthy. But there were plenty, and indeed a character in my book, Domingo, you know, who is not ready to go at first. Takes him a while before he thinks, I got to get out of here.
Well, when the revolution was happening, before Fidel took over, Did the people necessarily think of this as it was going to be a communist revolution?
No, absolutely not. I mean, Fidel, at the early part, you know, he said, I am no socialist, I am no communist. And in fact, there's some debate about where he stood on that. His brother Raul was a flat-out communist, and Che Guevara was even more extreme than Raul. These were guys who thought that Russia had sold out to market forces. They didn't think that Russian communism was strict enough.
Wow. What do you think it is that, and in your book, part of the conflict between, there's a conflict between Camilo and Raul, because Camilo is not in favor of communism. And was that historically accurate, that he was
Yeah, that is pretty historically accurate. But as I said before, he was a Fidelista. And in the book also, and in History, a famous incident where another comandante, Uber Matos, tried to retire from the revolution. He didn't like where it was going. He said, let me step back. I support you, but I don't want to be part of it anymore. I want to give up my role in this. And Fidel would, you know, you were either on the bus or off the bus. You couldn't step off the bus.
If you're not with me, you're against me.
There we are.
Yeah.
Yep. And they put that guy, they didn't kill him, but it was close. He did 20 years to the day in jail in Havana, and then got out and joined his wife and his family in Costa Rica.
Wow.
So Camilo had been asked to go arrest him. He was a good friend. They'd all fought together, and Camilo did arrest him.
Wow.
But he was going to be put in a delicate position.
And the president of Costa Rica, who comes to speak to speak in Havana after the revolution, tell us a little bit about him and the story behind that.
Yeah, Pepe Figueres. A wonderful guy who, in my mind at least, who brought all kinds of changes to Costa Rica. He abandoned the, you know, he dismantled the Costa Rican army and put all that money into social services. He gave women the right to vote in Costa Rica, and he was an early supporter of the revolution. He really hoped to see all kinds of revolutions, democratic revolutions. He was a democratic socialist, and he came to speak. He had sent a plane load of guns to Fidel early on, and he came. He was invited by Fidel to come over and speak to the nation, and they had these massive rallies where Fidel would sometimes speak for 4 or 5 hours. But Pepe Figueres came over, and he spoke, and it was a time of great conflict between the Russians and the U.S., and he said, if there, comes to be a conflict between Russia and the United States, we cannot take the side of the communists. We must take the side of the United States. At which point, another guy jumps up, grabs a microphone from him, and says, this will never happen. And then Fidel calls Pepe Figueres a bad communist and a bad friend. And that was the end of that. And that all happened, I don't change that history. But as you know, he figures later in the book.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, what about the, Camilo and Claire go to visit him before he leaves Cuba. Is that something that you fictionalized?
Yes, because there was no Claire, so
right,
I had to fictionalize that.
Obviously.
All this discussion about Camilo, it's all fascinating. And when I come to present the book in public, when I choose a cover for the book, look who's on the cover. It's Camilo Cienfuegos, because he's known by some, at least, and he's a dashing figure. And you can talk about what actually happened with him. But in fact, this book is really, look at the percentage of point of view from Camilo is probably maybe a quarter of the book, whereas Claire's has the rest. It's really her story and her battle or debate or conflicts with this man that she has fallen in love with and had a child by. And it's really a story about Claire and Claire and Camilo. And I sometimes feel that I'm cheating or something. I'm using Camilo because he's easy to talk about, and we look at all the fun we've had talking about Cuba and the history. And
right.
Whereas really, it's a novel. Novels, I've written both memoirs and novels. Novels are a lot harder to talk about. You have to talk about the whole character. You have to invent this person, and then.
Right, and you don't want to tell too much about the novel, about the plot, and about what happens. Then it's a spoiler.
Right.
That is true. You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is John Thorndike, author of 100 Fires in Cuba, which is a novel.
I was going to say, you really can't be a spoiler in this because so many things happen that you're not expecting. I mean, you can't put it down because you want to know what's going to happen next. It was well written that way. And I was interested too in Claire's perspective of being a photographer. She wanted to have pictures of the people and she did that, tried to do that. And then she worked for Life magazine and that was how she made some money, of course. But it was, And that was an interesting part that you did with her, having, instead of just being a housewife and a person there, she was actually part of the whole thing.
The reason for that, or what led me there, is that my father was managing editor of Life magazine in 1946 to 1949, and he knew all the Life photographers, and I was always aware of them, and so I kind of leaned on that. And I thought, well, I'll make my mother one of them. And there were women, Margaret Bourke White, who had the first cover on Life magazine, was a famous photographer. And
I wondered what, you know, how you, because there's a lot in here about how to, about getting the good, the right picture, knowing what to take, knowing how to work with, I mean, even how Camilo and Claire meet, where she is on assignment to take some pictures in this kitchen, and how she draws Camilo out through her lens. So I wondered how you, you know, I thought you must be a photographer yourself.
Yeah, yes, but nothing very professional. I'm a videographer, actually, but photography, I've always taken photos. But I think it does. It comes from those people that that my father knew and that I knew of at life. And, you know, I read Margaret Bourke White's book and Robert Capa's book, you know, to Robert Capa died, this famous photographer from World War II and later, and then he stepped on a landmine in Indochina in 1954 and died. But he had written this book, and as you see in my book, you see that my mother has read this book. She has kind of fantasized meeting Robert Capa. You know? And I think I got most of my fascination with it and some approach to how you would take photographs. For example, Claire remembers what Robert Capa says at one point: if your photos aren't good enough, you aren't close enough.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's true, and I think he was speaking particularly about battlefields. But sometimes, and Claire goes off to, you know, to try and meet Camilo at a time that she isn't able to, and there's a barricade there, and some of the citizens have closed the way, and they're all posing. And she says she could get as close as she liked. It didn't make any difference.
We did an interview some years ago with I think it was a goddaughter or something of Dorothea Lange, who was the famous Dust Bowl photographer, and she did a book about her life and, you know, about her photography. It was fascinating.
Yeah.
So that's another. But so you're right. You know, photography was one area where women were able to break in ways that they couldn't in some other areas.
Yeah. It's and there's a kind of romance and adventure about those early days of the different cameras they had, and the very fact that you're dealing with film. I mean, today, what a change it is that I can go out and take, you know, shoot a volleyball match. That's one of the things I do. And I could take 800 photos. You know, I put my, I put the camera on a burst mode because when the girl's going up to spike the ball, I want to get every instant of it. And then I come back and I erase 680 of them.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't the case with film.
Right.
You're much more deeply involved.
Yeah.
Talking about deeply involved, I decided I would start at the beginning again after I finished the book, and so I did. I couldn't remember how she met Domingo, and it was at the casino where this couple was gambling, and they were engrossed. They just wouldn't get up, and he was trying to get them away from the table, and so he saw her with the camera, and so he indicated her she should take pictures of them. So she kept taking pictures, and finally, the woman who was determined she was not going to stop, she was going to win, decided, okay, that's enough, and she got up. And I found that very interesting.
And the little detail in there that she's at first using her Leica, which is a rangefinder camera and therefore is silent. And, oh, she said, I'm not going to use this one. She switches to her Pentax, which is a single lens reflex. And it makes this clack every time she takes the picture. And that really gets to that cup, to that woman.
Yeah. I found that extremely interesting.
I'm very happy that you picked the book up, went back to the start. I love that.
John, you mentioned that you love volleyball, and I saw on your website that that's one of your passions. And I've also played volleyball and volleyball over the years. Have you ever played volleyball?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Oh,
fun.
Oh, yeah. And it's interesting because when a volleyball player first plays volleyball, they're not very good, no matter how good they are at volleyball, because
yeah.
it's because you have to react so differently to playing off the walls, which is
yeah.
what happens in volleyball.
Yeah.
But then, of course, the good volleyball players end up being the best volleyball players once they get the hang of it. But do you still play?
Play every Friday night and Sunday afternoon. Yep.
So, you know, it was interesting because I've been playing a little bit lately. I hadn't played for a few years, and now I'm playing on a women's recreational league. Not a big deal, but it's but most of the players are quite a bit younger than I am by 20.
Indeed, me
by
too.
20 years or more,
yeah.
And between 20 and 40 years, and you know, when I'm not playing volleyball, I feel like kind of slow. And, you know, sometimes it's hard to get down to look at something in a lower cupboard and get back up, or a lower bookshelf and stuff. But when I'm on the court, I can dive and fall and get back up, and it's no problem at all.
Oh, right. I love this. That's exactly the way I view the sport.
Yep. Yeah, it's really fun. It's a fun game, and I'm hoping I don't ever have to quit playing, but I don't know if there's 80-year-olds out on the volleyball court or not. I don't see too many, but...
Well, I'm looking at a sign on my wall, and we could translate this into volleyball as well. It says, I intend to live forever. So far, so good. So I could just cross that off and say, I intend to play volleyball forever.
So far, so good. So, John, why don't you read a little bit from 100 Fires in Cuba?
Okay, I've chosen, in line with what I said before about what this book is really about, this is a scene that winds up between Camilo and Claire. To set the background of this, they meet in New York, they have a 10-week affair, very passionate, and then he is sent out of the country by immigration, he's sent back to Cuba. He doesn't know that Claire is pregnant. And she has a child, and she never hears from Camilo, and she's still kind of in love with Cuba, with him. And Carolyn, as you mentioned, he goes down. She gets a job down she's taking pictures for Life at one of the
mm-hmm.
casinos, and there she meets Domingo, an older, wealthier, handsome, very nice guy, helps look after her daughter, and she moves down to Cuba, and then, kind of pressured by him, she marries him. And then she is listening to the radio one day. She thinks Camilo is dead because of so many of those people who came in on the grandma died that day that they landed, or in the next 3 days, that she's never heard from Camilo. She just thinks he's dead. And then all of a sudden she hears on the radio his name mentioned as one of the leaders. And now she tries to meet him. And she hasn't talked to him since their affair in New York. He doesn't know anything about her child and their child. And now he has come into town. He arrives in town before Che, before Fidel, and he goes in and takes over the army. And that's where this scene starts. The following morning, Claire rose in the dark and let herself out of Domingo's house. Because of the general strike, no taxis or buses were running, so she walked down the middle of the street, coatless and chilled, as the streetlights flickered off. The eastern sky turned lemon, the sun came up and poured its warmth across her back, and other walkers soon appeared on the streets, some greeting her with a cheerful buen dia, some smiling at the sky like young children. Hope was coming back to Cuba. Last night on the radio, she'd heard Fidel tell the nation that Camilo would be the first rebel commander to enter Havana, where he would take control of the Cuban army at Camp Columbia. She'd arranged for Rosa to come and look after Ala, that's her daughter, and with Domingo out at his sugar mill, she was on her own. In part, she felt the way people looked, happy and expectant. At the same time, she worried. What if she got through to Camilo, only to have him shrug her off? 100 yards short of the camp, she stopped, took her Leica from its bag, and attached her life pin to the lapel of her blouse. It came from the days when she worked for the magazine, and it had smoothed her way before. Usually just picking up a camera made her feel confident, but not today. At the last moment, she slipped off her wedding ring and stashed it in her bag. At the gate, three bearded sentries, full barbudos from the hills, stood guard in their ragged fatigues, their rifles held loosely as they stepped forward to block her way. "Señorita," said the first. Claire reached out and shook their hands, one after the other. Buenos dias, compadres. Could they be of some help, the soldier asked. I would like to speak to Camilo Cienfuegos. This brought a burst of laughter. You see how fast it starts, one of the other men said. We've been here for 6 hours, and already a woman wants to meet Camilo. No, Claire said, I'm a photographer. I work for a magazine. She lifted her lapel, unsure if these men would even know about life. It is lamentable, said the first soldier, but we have our orders. No civilians today, and no journalists. Listen, I know Camilo. We are friends. Of course. Everyone wants to be friends with El Chico Lindo, the beautiful boy. This was followed by another ripple of laughter. Was this how it was that women followed him around? Claire pulled back her shoulders. No, she told the sentry. I have known him for years. Of course, I'm sure it is so. And then I'll skip past, she's got to get past those sentries. And now they take her in, finally. Camilo stood behind a desk, half turned away, his broad felt hat pushed back on his forehead. His beard was full and his hair fell to his shoulders. How skinny he was. Camilo. He turned at her voice and for 5 dreadful seconds stared at her in silence. Claire waited, miserable. Didn't he know her? Would he keep looking at her as if they'd never met? Finally, it's you! He stepped toward her, put his arm around her, then leaned back to look her over. He stared at her face, at her shoulders and chest. He waved his other hand at the half-dozen men in his office. Leave us for a moment, and they all filed out. But the door remained open, with 2 guards just outside and soldiers passing by. How can this be? He said in English. On this perfect day, on this first day of the revolution, you are here. You are in Cuba. I've been here for months. I'm taking photos for Black Star and for a Cuban magazine. She was aware, as she spoke, of Camilo's hand moving slowly across the small of her back. He smelled of sweat and soil and clothes slept in for weeks at a time. The odor up close was overwhelming, and seeing her hold back, he laughed. Que olor, no? I must bathe, he said. I must sleep, but there is no time. I must smoke a cigar. I must dance in celebration, and still there is no time. And you come without telling me. How could I have told you? On the desk beside him lay his submachine gun, its wooden stock stained and dark, its barrel pointed toward the door. His beard was a jungle, and in it bits of something, perhaps bread, were caught beside his mouth. His hat was tattered and his cuffs frayed. He was a comandante, but looked the same as any of the bearded soldiers. More beautiful, though. What caution Claire had was dropping away like a skirt off her hips. And that scene goes on, but perhaps that's enough.
And that was John Thorndike reading from his novel, 100 Fires in Cuba. And you're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. So you've been to Cuba.
Yes, I went only once. I still want to go back and spend a long time there, but I went one time. I had to go look at the places where I'd set all these scenes and so on.
Right. And how open did you find people to talking to you about, you know, to helping you with the details of the setting?
Well, there I was in the setting, and so I could see some of it. But when it came to Camilo, as I said earlier, you know, not much is known about him. And People were very ready to talk about him, but they didn't know anything, to be honest. They had his birthplace all mixed up. They thought he was, you know, that he was born out in this little town where he fought a battle. And, you know, he's a hero, but heroes are sometimes known by just the outlines of their history.
So you felt welcomed there by the local people?
Oh, you could talk to anyone. I did, of course. I went with a little group, a kind of tour, led by Tom Miller, who's written a wonderful book on Cuba called Trading with the Enemy. But I didn't go around with them most of the time. I had research to do. I wanted to go out and see the places I wanted to see. And, I just went about on my own. And anybody to talk to, no one was following me around or asking me any questions or anything like that. It was quite a wonderful time.
I know that for many, many years, Americans couldn't go to Cuba directly, and then they could go, but only as part of an educational organization. And what's the status now for Americans visiting?
Oh, it's
Cuba?
Almost the same now. You can still go, and you're supposed to go as part of an educational. But, you know, before Obama opened things up, believe me, people were going to Cuba all the time. The only thing you had to do is you had to go through Mexico or through the Bahamas, and then you would fly from there into Cuba, and Cuba understood all this and would not mark your passport.
Okay, and yeah, so, I know people who went. Yeah. A photographer, actually.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Do you...
The most interesting person I spoke with down there, and this was set up by Tom Miller because he knew everybody, was a woman named Nati Revuelta, who had been one of Fidel's lovers, even as the revolution was starting, and had a child with her, a woman, Alina Fernandez, who still lives in Miami and is on the radio often down there. So I went to have lunch with her, and, you know, we just talked about things, and finally I said, you know, I'm writing this book about Camila Cienfuegos. Was I imagining that her whole posture stiffened slightly? Because you cannot mention Camila Cienfuegos with anybody who knows, you know, about the exiles in Miami without knowing that there's this big debate. Did Fidel have him killed? And she began to tell me this story about how she was in this office, the office where the government was being run out of. And she heard on that day Fidel screaming at Camilo. Camilo had gone down to arrest that guy that I mentioned, Uber Matos, and he hadn't come back. And Fidel would say, "You get back here right now. You come back now. No, you don't wait for that plane. You get on a bus. Get on a train. Get back here now." And as I put this in the book, it sounded, Fidel had run off the rails of reason. I mean, he was just wait an hour for the plane, and he'd be home long before taking the train, which was an overnight ride. And I was kind of amazed at the start that Nati Revuelta was telling me how angry Fidel was at Camilo on the day he disappeared.
Wow.
But then later I thought about it, and I thought, this could have been kind of a cover. Because this was Fidel saying, don't get on that plane. Don't get on the plane. The plane that later disappeared.
Okay.
So it made it seem like he didn't want Camila on that plane. But his advice was crazy, and this is the kind of stuff that, you know, you make. It won't do to write a book of history on this basis, because it's kind of my suppositions.
Right.
But
right.
That was the most interesting thing that happened to me down there.
Now, did I pick up from when you were explaining about this woman that she had a daughter with Fidel who lives in Miami?
Yes, yeah, Alina Fernandez. I've met her too, actually.
And why would Fidel's daughter not have stayed in Cuba?
Well, Fidel did not look after her very well. He just didn't look after her at all. And she didn't know until she was 10, I think, that she was Fidel's daughter.
Okay.
Because her mother had been married to another guy. And then Fidel, in my book, in my literal book, or in my theories, not terribly responsible about his children. He had a lot of them. And, you know, through his first wife, he had a boy, Fidelito, who's also in my book. And he didn't look after him. He stole him from his mother, basically, after the revolution. And then they just sent him away to school. And
whatever became of him?
He committed suicide about 3 or 4 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So you went to Cuba to look at the settings. Did you? And I assume you've been in the areas of New York that you wrote about. How about Miami and Costa Rica?
Also Miami, also Costa Rica.
Okay.
Yep.
And in Miami, you know, there's a large Cuban community. Are all of them refugees from the revolution, or people were fleeing Cuba because of Batista before the revolution, and did some of them stay? And so you have a mix of people who were fleeing Batista and people who were fleeing the revolution.
Yes, it's a mix, but it's the vast majority fled the communist revolution. Mm. A few, you know, you have to go back so far to the Batista people. And you know, you have people who are still coming up. I mean, it's been a steady stream. It was especially heavy in 1959, 60, 61 in there, but they're still coming. I was at the Miami Book Fair, and my stallmate was a woman who grew up a complete devotee of the revolution. She was sent to a camp where she was trained, and she was trained as an engineer, and you know, was a true believer. And then just it wore on her and wore on her, and then she came up to the U.S. and now she's on the other side.
Wow. Well, you know, we look at the revolution as having been a failed socialist experiment. But how much of the failure do you think is due to the obstacles that the United States put in their way?
I think it's enormous. You know, this is now we're getting right into politics, and it's always delicate. But it's just crazy. We're trying, and you know, you get the politicians from South Florida are just absolutely firm on this. You know, we must be stricter and harder. We cannot open up to Cuba. And, oh, we have been doing this for 55, almost 60 years.
Yeah.
And what's the point of it? It doesn't work. Let's just open everything up and give them the internet, you know, the natural flow.
And how much do you think the United States kind of rejection of the revolution drove Fidel into the arms of the Russians?
I think it was always a comfortable way for him to go in that direction. But we did drive him. You know, we cut out the sugar imports from Cuba, and that really crippled their economy. And yes, I think he overplayed it, and they still overplay it. But it's definitely true.
Yeah,
I think so.
Yeah,
I had some friends who went there last summer, I think it was, and he was commenting how many old cars there were on the streets.
Yeah,
he thought that was interesting.
Yeah, because they, you know, they imported lots of American cars right up until through 1958. And then suddenly that was the end of it. And so there are all these old DeSotos and Packards and Fords and Chevys you know, it's not that's all the cars. Most of them are Japanese and Korean, and for a long time they had Russian Ladas. Those are all old and much despised. But, you know, I actually did a count both in Havana and out in the country, and I thought somewhat less than maybe between 20 and 25% of the cars were old American cars. And and then I took a ride when I went out to this little town to the west of Havana in this car. It was an old Chevy, but it had a lot of transmission in it. As well as power windows. They're quite inventive.
So, John, this is not your first book. Can you tell us a little bit about your history as a writer?
Yeah, let me say I wrote two novels my first two books were novels, one about a woman whose nine-year-old son dies in a car crash, the worst loss I could think of, and the second about a couple who's been married for 20 years. And then I came along and I wrote a memoir about raising my son. His mother was a schizophrenic, and I got him when he was three. And then more to the point with this book is that in 2004, 2005, I went to live with my father, where he lived on Cape Cod, in his last year. And he was 90, then 91 years old, and he had Alzheimer's. And so I wrote a book about that year called The Last of His Mind. And that really plays with regard to this book, because it was after that that I thought, I've written all this stuff about my dad. I want to write about my mother as well. And that was the generating force for this book. That's where I started to just to think about it and, you know, to invent some characters. And that's what got me going on this book, was that I had written an entire book about my dad.
You know, I'm curious, you talk about, you wrote a memoir about raising your son whose mother had schizophrenia. How did your son feel about you writing that story?
He's always been great. I told him I wouldn't publish anything that he didn't want me to write. And there were a couple of things in there. I can't even remember what they were now. But I cut those out. But he went along with everything. He did not have a good history with his mother. I mean, she was actually fabulous in the first kind of year and a half of his life. But he can't remember that.
Yeah.
And he once told me, this is 5 or 10 years ago, he said, you know, Dad, I don't have one good memory of my mother. And that actually, you know, that in a way had something to do with me writing that, because I wanted to show her before the schizophrenia. And, you know, I have many good memories of her, plenty of troubled memories, but he has no good memories. That was really a sad thing to hear.
And and writing about your father, were there other, like, do you have siblings and so forth that you sort of cleared things with before you published?
Yes, I have a brother and a half-brother. I just call them my two brothers. And both wonderful guys and both extremely helpful. I was the one who wasn't married, who didn't have a two-year-old child, who didn't have a steady job. I was the one who moved, you know, just left everything and went to move in with my dad because that's what he wanted. He did not want to go to some home. And they, of course, they couldn't do as much as I was doing, but both of them were a tremendous help. One of my brothers is a lawyer. He took care of all the finances and the legal stuff. They didn't object to, they had a few pointers, but they were both very supportive.
And the that book looks like won quite a few awards, a best book of 2009 from the Washington Post, an indie top 20 from Publishers Weekly, and so forth.
Yeah.
And your current book, 100 Fires in Cuba, has also generated some really nice attention. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the greatest for me is Kirkus. Many readers don't know anything about Kirkus, but in the book industry, Kirkus is one of the two primary early reviewers. The other is Publishers Weekly. And Kirkus is rather famous for being severe. They don't like plenty of books, and they'll tell you. I've been reviewed. I've been reviewed by Kirkus 4 times before this book. And I'd never gotten a starred review. They were okay, but it wasn't a starred review, which they only give to a number of the books. And this time I got a starred review from Kirkus. I was quite happy. And then they come along and they give me a best book of the year, one of 7 in the indie published historical fiction. And that was a treat. I was dancing.
Now, is this book, tell us about your publishing story, you know, how you got this book published, and is it the same or a different type of publishing realm than your other books?
Well, my first three books were published by New York houses, and that was good, but, you know, they don't have the time and attention to give to people and books. I find it very difficult. Many have complained about it. You know, if you're a huge bestseller, okay. And then I published the fourth book about my dad with a press right here in Athens, Ohio, the Ohio University Press. It's actually Swallow Press, which is part of the OU Press. And they were so great. They were really great to deal with. They don't have quite the clout, but, they were wonderful. And, but then this book, being a novel, it's less in there. They don't do much fiction. So I had met a guy at the Ohioana Book Festival named Raul Ramos y Sanchez, a Cuban American who had come up here when he was 8 years old. And he had a little publishing house called Beck and Branch. And so I just joined up with him, and he was a tremendous help. He and Rebecca Coffey, who's the other main partner in that. And it's, you know, when you do it yourself, you've got a lot of work to do. But the fact is, if you're doing it with the New York house, you've got a lot of work to do. You're going to do it yourself. They're not going to do it for you. And
right. So using a small independent press, you don't have to do everything that you would have to do if you were self-publishing.
And you get to, say, choose the cover you want rather
yes.
than the ridiculous cover that Crown Publishing wants.
So you get more independence, more control.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Help with the technical parts and so forth, where you don't have to learn everything about laying out a book or
right. Well,
like
I hired out the layout, the formatting of the
okay,
book. Anyway,
okay.
Right now I'm in the midst of making an Audible version, and that's the most challenging technological thing I've ever done in my life.
Oh, I bet.
But it's fun.
And do you have we're almost out of time, but are you working on another book?
Well, you know, because this book was supposed to be about my mother, or Claire was, you know, kind of generated by my mother, I soon saw that she had gone into Cuba and become a different kind of person. And now the next one I'm doing is I'm going to say as close to my mother's life as I can and invent whatever I want. It's a tremendous freedom. So the next book is really about her.
And how far along are you?
I've written the whole thing. But that doesn't mean it's finished. That just means I have the first draft
or
some of them is fifth draft and other parts, you know, before we get to the 20th draft for one chapter and the 18th for the other, still a bunch of work to do.
Well, I look forward to seeing that book when it comes out. Mom, do you have some final words for us?
Yes, I do. I think after you read this book, I think you'll understand what this is. The scars of life can remind us where we have been. They don't have to dictate where we're going, and that's true of Camilo and Claire.
That I love that. I'm going to repeat that myself.
Well, thanks for being with us today, John.
I much enjoyed it, and it's so clear that the two of you had read the book and knew it well. It's a treat.
Well, that's what we do here on Writers' Voices, and see you all next week.